I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, Fox News turned 25. Media Matters, an organization that watches Fox more than probably anyone, says it's been a disaster and it's only getting worse. Media Matters notes that as the year began, Fox actively pushed efforts by Republicans in Congress to block the counting of the official electoral votes. When a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol on January 6th, Fox's, quote, straight news coverage seriously downplayed the violence. Fox Business anchor Maria Bartiromo claimed 2 weeks after the Capitol attack that, quote, Democrats infiltrated 2 weeks ago and put on MAGA clothing. The Daily Beast reports that Tucker Carlson's revisionist January 6th documentary was written by Scooter Downey, a filmmaker who's worked on documentaries for white nationalists. Tucker Carlson, who often has the most watched show on cable, has also used his show to spread false claims that thousands of people have been killed by the COVID vaccines. As a whole, the network has relentlessly sought to undermine vaccines and celebrates people who refuse to get vaccinated. Media Matters reports that the network requires its own employees to take the vaccines and undergo daily testing. Fox reaches millions and millions of people. According to Nielsen, it's about 3 to 4 million people daily, which beats the other networks. But that is just part of the number. So many more people see Fox videos on YouTube and Facebook. And then there are Fox competitors like Newsmax and OAN, and they push dangerous conspiracy theories around vaccines, masks in schools, and now critical race theory. A new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center looks at the rise of podcasts and YouTube shows by white supremacists and far-right extremists. So how big is the right-wing media machine today? How dangerous is it? And how can we counter disinformation and lies? Today, we're joined by Angelo Carasone, president and CEO of Media Matters, a progressive research and information center dedicated to monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation. Angelo joined Media Matters back in 2010. Hi, Angelo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's kind of amazing when you think about, I remember when Fox launched 25 years ago. So much has changed since then. But since, you know, Fox kind of started all of this, and you have done so many reports about Fox, just give us a sense of how big Fox has become over those years.
I mean, so, you know, when you think about Fox's size and significance, obviously their audience is substantial for, you know, for a cable news channel. You know, they average around 3.5 million viewers. It's a good size, but their real power is in the agenda setting power. And, you know, it is in their ability to take something seemingly out of nowhere and make it the dominant news story within the right wing echo chamber, and then eventually to infiltrate all of it. So for example, 2 years ago, nobody ever said the word critical race theory, right? I mean, it just was not something that was common knowledge. And then, you know, Fox in this spring can devote, you know, 1,900 segments to it. And before long, it's something that we all know, right? And that is not a one-off instance. That is an example of how just powerful they can, you know, they can be when it comes to, you know, media manipulation and amplification.
I think this is such a good point because you just reminded me of another example when President Obama didn't wear a flag lapel pin on his suit. Fox just went ballistic over this, and lo and behold, it became a question during the debates.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, that is, you know, there's so many, you know, like cultural zeitgeist moments that were actually manufactured or trumped up or hyped by Fox News. I mean, the idea that, you know, nowadays with COVID, a lot of people are fist pumping, but, you know, back in 2008, Fox used to call that the terrorist fist jab. You know, and people maybe say that now as a joke, but that was a serious Fox News segment that they thought Michelle Obama and Barack Obama were giving some kind of secret Muslim symbol to each other on stage, and that it was a warning for everyone. You know, they do these things that, you know, that can end up getting real significance. Some of them are silly and they don't really have real harms. They're just kind of, you know, that you can laugh at them. But some of them are really damaging and powerful and harmful. So, you know, when when they were warning about this caravan a couple years ago in October, they were hyping up this idea that there was an invasion coming in from through Mexico, but mostly comprised of South Americans and Central Americans. They devoted a disproportionate amount of coverage to manufacturing this threat. And it got so intense that one guy who was a viewer started mailing bombs to the people that he thought were organizing the caravan. George Soros, CNN's headquarters had a bomb mailed to it. And so, you know, it's an example where not only did it pollute our coverage, but it then started to lead to additional harms. And it was a total fabrication. There was no army invading us that, you know, that was being ignored. But it was, you know, it was a Fox story for 3 weeks.
You talked about their viewership, and even though it feels like the cable shows have a lot of influence, when you look at the numbers, 3 to 4 million people, it seems pretty small. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the videos. And last October, the New York Times reported that after the 2016 election, engineers at YouTube wanted to change their algorithm because they, like so many other social media companies, realized publicly, this came out publicly, that their recommendations tended to steer viewers toward videos that were hyperpartisan, misleading, or just downright false. And so they changed the algorithm. And then what happened? Well, Ghulam Chazlot, a former Google engineer who helped build YouTube's recommendation engine and now studies it, says the channel most recommended in our data set in 2016 was Alex Jones, who has since been barred from YouTube. Well, now it's Fox News.
Yeah, that says a lot, right? And, you know, they really did fill a void. You know, the more that the platforms started to crack down on some of the fringe, one of the effects of that is that it actually started to make its way increasingly into Fox's coverage, right? Because there was an audience share there. So, you know, that YouTube example tracks really neatly with a whole range of other instances where Fox would uplift things from the fever swamps. So, for instance, the platforms, YouTube and Facebook, had been cracking down in the spring of this year on a conspiracy theory about this VAERS database, which is, you know, these vaccine incident reporting systems. It's like an open system where people can go and they took a vaccine, they can report an incident. It's not a scientific thing at all. It's just sort of like this massive repository of unrefined information. But they had been promoting this conspiracy theory that 10,000 people had died from taking the vaccine. Americans had died from taking the vaccine. Total bogus hoax. Well, it got ignored by, you know, it wasn't really a big part of our public discussion. The platforms were taking the channels that were promoting this offline. And then all of a sudden, Fox News goes all in May on this conspiracy theory that thousands of Americans have died from taking the vaccine. And what happens? The very content that YouTube and Facebook had actually been removing and the channels that they had been penalizing for taking offline was now being spread to a massive audience online because it was being packaged and distributed under the Fox News banner. So not only does Fox, you know, contribute to this problem, but one of the, I think, the big takeaways, especially in this moment where there has been some crackdowns, is that the rules don't tend to apply to them. So while YouTube will take Alex Jones offline, for instance, they won't enforce the same policies against Fox News, even if the content is identical.
So we talked about YouTube. The same thing applies to Facebook. The Times reports that Facebook, which has also tweaked its algorithms to steer people toward more reliable information, has shown similar results. Fox has far outperformed other large news outlets when measured by users' interactions with posts.
And I think it is a reflection of a few things. One, it's a reflection of the material and the substance itself. You know, they're producing the most high valence, highly charged claims, which therefore, you know, lead to engagement. But it's also deeper than that. And it actually gives you a small sort of keyhole view of the rest of the right-wing media, because there's one really important difference maker to consider here. A lot of Fox's power and influence is built on top of a broader right-wing echo chamber that really was birthed through talk radio And, you know, Rush Limbaugh had 25 million, 30 million listeners at some points for decades. And one of the things that he used to do when he had that perch is, you know, Rush Limbaugh fans would call themselves ditto heads, meaning I echo back outside the things I hear on Rush Limbaugh's show. They built this amplification imperative, this muscle memory to sort of evangelize the ideas that you were hearing on the radio. And when you do that for decades with that many people, one of the things that Fox has been able to take advantage of, but also the broader right-wing media, and it is clear when you look at the way that they can operate online, is that they benefit from that very muscle memory. When I see something on Fox and it's being promoted to me on Facebook, I not only engage with it, but I share it, I promote it, which helps it spread. You know, we call misinformation, you know, information and things online, they go viral, right? Because it's all about what those individuals are doing with that content. And what you have is both a combination of the content, but then decades of muscle memory built into the audiences to not just passively consume it, but then to subsequently enhance it, to supercharge it, to engage with it. And the algorithms have deeply rewarded them. And so everything about Fox, the harms, the ability to disseminate disinformation and misinformation, the extremism, is actually accelerating in large part because of the larger audience that exists online and Fox's need to begin to transition in order to capture and influence more directly that part of the audience.
Well, let's play a quick clip just to let listeners know what Fox viewers are hearing. This is Fox anchors whitewashing January 6th, and this is from Media Matters.
Insurrection of January 6th. Remember that? It's when a bunch of middle-aged people deep in credit card debt, white supremacists, teamed up with a guy dressed like Chewbacca to overthrow our democracy.
Group of largely unarmed housewives and dads walk into the Capitol, most of whom were nonviolent.
People who I believe engaged in nonviolent protest at the Capitol are effectively being treated like political prisoners in our country.
These people now are being treated as hardened criminals, a lot of nonviolent offenses, most of them first-time offenders.
That is a clip from Media Matters. You know, I think what's scary about this, Angelo, is if you're only relying on Fox for mm-hmm. information, your perspective information about January 6th, for example, is so incredibly narrow. I mean, I know some people who watch Fox and they didn't know anything about the cops testifying on Capitol Hill. They didn't know much about how one cop felt like he almost lost his life. So that's what I think is pretty dangerous about this. It's such a narrow view.
It really is. And I think, you know, I always try to look at the examples to say, well, where we have a real clear illustration of how their, to your point, their content, their narrow view can shape or create alternative perspectives that are just not grounded in reality. Right after the election, Fox, just if you just look at the first 9 days, you know, Fox had undermined the election explicitly, just challenged the results at least 600 times. That trend continued for the remaining 2 weeks. And there's research on this. And one of the things within, there was some polling done 3 weeks after the election. And if, you know, people that did not watch Fox News, 70% of them accepted the election results as, you know, as acceptable. But if you were a frequent Fox viewer, only 18%. So, you know, 82% of Fox viewers at that point did not accept Fox's the election results as legitimate. I mean, truly, almost, you know, the opposite of what the rest of any other media consumer had. The other part about that, and it gets to your point about what things they choose to expose them to, if you were just an occasional Fox viewer, so not a diehard, not only Fox, but if you watched some other stuff, it was 50-50, meaning that just a little bit of information outside of Fox News was actually able to bring that number down from 82% against the election to 50% accepting the results. And it really, really does, I think, capture how powerful that they can create these alternative perspectives. And then when you bring it to something like January 6th, it minimizes the real threat that took place there, not just at the Capitol that day, but to our democracy. Mm-hmm. And instead, it turns it into another example where it feels more partisan bickering or something small when it's actually quite consequential. And I think now it's even evolved since that video into, some suggestions that this was a false flag attack that was set up by the FBI in order to make conservatives look bad. And that's where it starts to get even scarier, because it creates conditions for those people not just to not believe what happened, but actually start to take up a cause against the government.
Today, we're speaking with Angelo Carusone, president and CEO of Media Matters, a progressive research and information center dedicated to monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation. And today, we're talking about how things have changed since Fox News first launched 25 years ago. If you have any questions or comments about the right-wing media machine, what really stands out for you? If you have lost any family members to right-wing media, yesterday we talked about the increase in political violence in the United States. And after the show, we did get an email from someone, I'll read part of it, who lost her husband to Fox. There's actually a book about a woman who lost her dad to Fox. And we're actually thinking about doing a show about this right before the holidays. Any comments at all about right-wing media? And if you listen to some of these outlets, what would you like to share about the information that they provide their listeners and viewers? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Angelo, I'm so glad you brought up talk radio, because we tend to now focus on Fox and OAN and InfoWars and all of that. But the New York Times has a piece called How Right-Wing Radio Stoked Anger Before the Capitol Siege. Talk radio is perhaps the most influential and under-chronicled part of right-wing media, where the voices of Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, and other star hosts are in the homes and the workplaces and the commutes of tens of millions of listeners. Vox points out that if you look at the top 15 top talk radio programs in the country, all but just a couple are conservative. So at a time when the media is really shrinking, can you talk about the power of conservative talk radio?
You know, talk radio I think that's a great point too. It is totally underappreciated in terms of its significance. It's, I think, because of the nature of the medium, and also because visual always tends to have that reaction. It just feels realer. And it's also harder to monitor. And I think most people just aren't familiar with how substantial this is. But talk radio basically can build, it fleshes out the world that, the rest of the right-wing media that we kind of get in snippets and slivers does. So let me give an example. So Sean Hannity has a show every day on Fox for, about an hour. He has a three-hour radio program, though. His three-hour radio program tracks exactly the same as his one-hour TV show. The only difference is that every segment is much more expanded. And he goes into way more detail. There's much more examples, anecdotes, stories. That's what makes radio such a powerful medium, is that it actually does have higher levels of engagement. There are callers on radio. There are not callers on Fox News, on TV. That makes it a powerful medium, because it does make it more community-oriented. It helps people contextualize what they heard by hearing from fellow listeners. And the scale of it is just so enormous. Even when we look back to 2016, everyone thinks about the fake news crisis and how many of the fake online things were helping spread misinformation. And the thing that my mind immediately goes to is not just that it was a problem online, but that what made it really bad was when local news stations started picking up that content and doing it as news reads, because it was not only spreading it to larger audiences online, but was sanitizing it. People still assume that traditional media has some guide rails as to how far you can say that. So there's some degree of quality control. And so it benefits a lot from the intuition that people have about media. They assume that it has to have some kernel of truth. It benefits from the engagement from callers and from the depth that you can go into in talk radio. It benefits from the fact that in a lot of places, people have to commute quite a bit of time, and the only thing they have access to is conservative talk. And so that helps just constantly stoke and reinforce what they're hearing. And it also benefits from not having a ton of accountability imposed on it. And ultimately, it is really the underbelly and the engine of the right-wing echo chamber. I mean, Hannity has 15 to 18 million radio listeners. He has 2.5 to 3 million TV viewers. I mean, his radio show is significantly more influential than his TV show, yet you very rarely hear about that.
I mean, this is amazing. I'm thinking about how much work we put into this 1 hour show. To think that Sean Hannity is doing an hour of TV and 3 hours of radio a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Steve Bannon was doing 6 hours of radio in the lead up to January 6th every day, 7 days a week. You know, there were days on the weekends he was producing 5 to 6 hour shows 7 days a week. And I think it shows the flip side of your question too, that part of what happened is he saw the benefit of producing a program for political purposes. And so they added shows in much the same way that in the past, you know, a lot of I would think about talk radio as both a combination of a massive get out the vote operation, but also like a legislative whip. You know, they would generate calls to not just moderates or people on one side to drive legislation or to critique legislation, to put targets on the backs of certain, you know, elected officials that they wanted to move into a different direction. And they can generate thousands of calls because a big part of talk radio is, you know, you hear a number, you get the direct response, you call the advertiser, you buy the product. You know, it builds in a behavioral pattern that a lot of listeners are able to follow through on. And it's a real potent force, truly.
It really is. And what's so sad is a lot of what they say, they most likely do not believe, and they're taking so many people for a ride. And I just have one example. You just reminded me of this amazing piece in The Nation in August by Marie Iuhara called The Anti-Asian Roots of Today's Anti-Immigrant Policies. And she writes, Trump had been fairly pro-immigrant until 2014, when his political advisors identified what would become a central campaign message after listening to what one described as thousands of hours of talk radio and finding that the Republican base was rabid about, quote, illegal immigration. Armed with this insight, Trump tapped into what the political scientist Larry Bartles of Vanderbilt has called a reservoir of relatively stable anti-immigrant sentiment that can be dormant or activated depending on the messaging, and the depths of that reservoir of anti-immigrant sentiment may very well have been carved out in the 19th century West. So basically she's saying that, you know, immigration really benefited Trump because of all of his hotels. And then his people listen to thousands of hours of talk radio and find that the base is rabid about immigration. Well, boom, look how he started his campaign.
Yes. And you know what's amazing about that too? I mean, that's such a great piece. And the thing that's amazing about that moment was at the same time that was happening, that, you know, and it was because talk radio had become such a cauldron of anti-immigrant sentiment during that time period. One of the things that Republican leadership had decided was that they needed to soften the tone on immigration for political purposes. They were trying to push some legislation through, and they actually began a very deliberate outreach. In fact, Marco Rubio was tapped as the individual to do these overtures. And he met with Roger Ailes, who at that point was running Fox News, Sean Hannity, and a few other prominent talkers, and basically laid the data case to them that they needed to ratchet down their conversation. And they actually all did. So there was this brief moment where after stoking the fire for years, and to that point, actually giving Trump his one of that little ember that he was able to latch onto as a part of his campaign, they actually, in coordination with Republicans, Rubio was the point person who had been the one designated to communicate these things to them, started to ratchet down their rhetoric, but that didn't change the perception of their listeners. And so when Trump comes along, he was actually giving them something that they so desperately wanted and hadn't been able to get for a little bit of time, because talk radio and Fox at that point had very deliberately dialed back some of the rhetoric at the request of Republican leadership. Hmm.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about the right-wing media machine and how it's really changed since Fox News launched 25 years ago. We're joined today by Angelo Carusone, president and CEO of Media Matters, a progressive research and information center that monitors, analyzes, and corrects conservative misinformation in the U.S. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about how the right-wing media machine has really exploded since Fox launched 25 years ago. If you have any questions or comments about right-wing media, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Angelo Carusone, president and CEO of Media Matters. They have been monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. for many, many years. Now I'd like to welcome Emily Dreyfus to the show. Emily is senior editor at the Technology and Social Change Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Emily covers the impacts of technology on society with a focus on social media and information systems. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound great. Thank you.
Wonderful.
So, Emily, we've been talking just about the influence of Fox, what has changed since Fox launched 25 years ago, and really the explosion of the right-wing media machine. Given the kind of work that you do at the Technology and Social Change Project, how should we think about this right-wing media machine? I mean, especially a show like this, where we focus on social issues, you know, climate change, how to deal with poverty and inequality. We don't really want to spend that much time, frankly, talking about all of this stuff on Fox and OAN, but we can't ignore it. So how should we think about this at this point?
That's a really good question. So, you know, the right-wing media ecosystem, as I'm sure you guys have discussed, is a whole different breed than what might be considered left-wing partisan media. It's really completely different. There's not something commensurate on the left. The new intensely partisan right-wing media, which largely is online, but not only, as you mentioned, Newsmax and OAN, is frankly, as I'm sure Angelo can, I hope Angelo would attest, is really specifically antagonistic toward the media. It is toward the mainstream media, including public radio, because the position that most of these outlets take is that the mainstream media is coming from a position of neoliberal values that they disagree with completely. And their intention is to be antagonistic, to take things from mainstream media, frame them in a different light for their audience, and really point out the ways in which, you know, they disagree with the mainstream culture and media as an avatar for that. You know, in terms of the issues that you guys discuss, social issues, these are the kinds of wedge issues that partisan, extreme partisan far-right media uses to get excitement, to excite their base, to drive division. These are the kind of hot topic issues that they like to listen to how others on the left or in the middle talk about, and then weaponize those words in reaction. And you know what I would say is, so many studies have shown that they're really successful in provoking a response from the mainstream or from the left media. And in that way, they are really good at setting the agenda for what the news as a whole is discussing. Nice. So one of the best ways to combat against it is to just not fall for that. And, you know, you don't need to respond unless you need to.
Well, how do you do that, though? Because when you look at something like critical race theory, if Fox is doing show after segment about critical race theory, all of a sudden it trickles down to the rest of the media. And we just saw that happen.
Absolutely. It's so hard. Social media has also changed everything because the right-wing partisan ecosystem is really good at engaging their audience and using their audience as a as distributors of their content. So they really kind of treat them like we're all on a team together. We're really interested in CRT now, and you need to be as well. And so then their own audience is out there pushing it and sharing the hashtag and making it go everywhere. And once there's that kind of action happening on social media nowadays, then the other mainstream media ends up covering it because that itself becomes a story and feels like this is in the ether. We really have to discuss it. You know, there's a joke people say that like Twitter is the assignment editor of the internet, and they use that to great effect. So once something has gotten to the stage where it's being talked about everywhere and people are yelling it in, you know, meetings in their local school district, and it's all over every single newspaper, you know, what we show in our research about media manipulation is that this, all of this is a cycle. And CRT follows that cycle. The CRT example follows that cycle exactly. So in there's five stages. And the first stage is the kind of planning and bubbling up of an idea for a campaign to manipulate the media's attention. The second stage is the sharing of that idea out onto social media, the seeding of it. And stage three is where media, often right-wing media, but not exclusively, amplifies that narrative. So with CRT, once it got to the point where it was totally amplified everywhere, the next phase is mitigation. And what mainstream media and you know, other news outlets can do at that point, when it's already been platformed so much, is work to contextualize the fact that the reason it's everywhere is because there is a concerted campaign to make it be everywhere for, in order to achieve certain goals and for, you know, to push an agenda. I think that at some point, like being transparent about the fact that this is not an authentic thing that just bubbled up out of nowhere. It's being pushed by operatives. They have every reason to do it. And to kind of pull the curtain back about that, that is one of the most profound ways we can engage with that.
It's such a good point. And Angelo, it's so important to follow the money on these issues. The Daily Beast has identified 8 recently created anti-CRT groups, which operate at local levels across the country, but have ties to former Trump officials, Koch entities, and the Federalist Society. Maurice Cunningham, a political science professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and the author of a book about dark money, said the folks who fund this also oppose public education and the distribution of public goods. So it's so important when you have a campaign like this that takes off so fast to really tear back the layers and follow the money.
Exactly right. I mean, we saw this a little bit, you know, in a smaller scale, but last year, you know, I guess around early April, when a lockdown said first really started to permeate, and there were this prevalence of these groups called reopen groups that had started popping up all over Facebook. And when we started to look into them, a lot of them were started by the same operatives who were basically commercializing, you know, the ability to basically trying to capitalize on and commercialize you know, the sentiment and the frustration that people felt being home. And obviously that meant you tapped into the larger right-wing conspiracies, but you give that organizing hub. I mean, these were not entirely organic. There were people capitalizing on it. And I often give this thought experiment to people, and it's scary, but I mean it, which is that, you know, a lot, if you're in the space and you know it well enough, you could, you know, we could leave my job right now, all 3 of us. We wanted to quit. And tomorrow we could start a misinformation operation online. And within 6 months, we could probably make $1 million easy. Just by tapping into the existing like network of people that want this content, and if we tailored it right, we would be able to monetize it through a combination of advertisements, but as well as fundraising. I mean, you know, getting people to chip in money to stick it to the New York Times or Washington Post or to defund talk radio is a pretty easy thing to raise money for in this vast right-wing network. It just is.
Yeah, and I would just add to that. Sorry, I just wanted to say I completely agree. And also, we would be able to sell merch. You know, a lot of...
Yes, that's it. Well, right, merch. See, we're starting a business.
Yeah, I mean, and that is what it is. You know, it is a business. It's a really lucrative business and the rules are totally different. And like the norms are totally different than what mainstream media would consider. Like, we don't sell T-shirts that say take down Fox News, you know?
Right, right. Well, Emily, before we get to our next caller, is there any data out there looking at the reach of a network like Fox versus the reach of some of these Q YouTube shows, these white supremacist podcast shows that are now really springing up? The Southern Poverty Law Center has a 3-part series about these far right podcasts, and apparently it's really growing. So do we have any sense of just the reach of these different far right media outlets, or whatever you'd like to call them, far right information systems?
You know, Angelo might know the specific numbers. I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, although there are so many people who have looked into this. But the thing is, these networks are, they amplify each other. And so, you know, the Q influencers on YouTube are amplified by Q influencers on Twitter, who are amplified by Q influencers on 8chan, who are amplified by Q influencers on Reddit, who then send out a newsletter, who then make a podcast. And so, you know, it's a snowball effect. So I would be hesitant to say, you know, that something like QAnon has less of an audience than Fox, even though we know Fox has millions of viewers. And that is because, you know, in some ways, QAnon was itself and remains a distribution network for conspiracy theories. QAnon, you know, accepts and filters in all sorts of various different conspiracies that work for the people who believe it at that time. And they use that hashtag and those networks and those the infrastructure that they've built around all of those different shows and podcasts and media forums to push all sorts of right wing content and conspiracy content. Angela, do you have anything else?
I would just add that I think that any of the data barely exists, and I think that is a sense of where we're going in the future. You know, Fox and the traditional media that have one business model, one approach, need to consolidate and provide good metrics, because that's how they can monetize, advertise, commercialize it. But a lot of what we're this, and this is the trend that the rest of the information landscape is moving to, is much more peer-to-peer, deeply distributed. Yeah. It's not about immediate conversion or views in a single platform. It's designed to be much more peer-to-peer and distributed. And that's going to be hard for all of us, because we're going to have to learn to ask a different set, ask and answer who matters and when do they matter. You know, when you have a static program like Fox, they almost always mattered because of where they were in the information landscape. And because of how rapidly it's transforming, these peer-to-peer networks will matter a lot more in certain instances and not matter very much. And that's ultimately what the question about reach and size is about, is the significance to distort or influence a conversation or a policy fight or a culture debate. There really just aren't good metrics here. And a lot of it is private groups, closed groups, and it's going to be a real challenge moving forward, not just to monitor, but also to get a good handle on the scale.
Yeah, I just want to second that completely and say that, you know, also we need the help, journalists need the help, and watchdogs need the help of technology platforms who, you know, could do more to make this data transparent for us, because we're not able right now to very easily see how many people are being reached by QAnon on Facebook, for instance. It's really hard to track specific hashtags in closed environments online, and we could have a lot more help with that. The other thing I wanted to just quickly mention in terms of Fox, you know, Fox has, I would say, realized that they are losing ground to some far right viewers, to Newsmax, to OAN, to these other online places. And so they have recently launched their own app, And they put different content on that app than is on their television show. And in some ways right now, that is functioning so that they can put their more kind of intense, more fringe ideas on a platform to their viewers that they think fewer people are watching. Like, they might not actually have said this thing on air. Tucker Carlson may not have had on, you know, like a far right philosopher who is one of the first people who coined the idea red pill on his actual show on Fox, but he did on this app. So we also just have to be constantly looking at like where is the conversation moving to so that we can observe.
Today, we are talking about the right-wing media machine with Emily Dreyfus, senior editor at the Technology and Social Change Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. We're also joined by Angelo Carusone, president and CEO of Media Matters. And let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Nancy. Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I do not understand why NPR... your show and some of the other talk shows, why you feel that it's necessary to put on conservative and right-wing people because you think you need to be fair. They have enough platforms. I get very upset when I hear these people on NPR. There is no reason to put these people on. They have Fox News. They have other places in which to spew their misinformation. And NPR does not have to give them a platform.
Well, thank you for the comment, Nancy. In fact, there's a lot of media analysts, media critics who are really talking about exactly what you're saying. And we're planning to have a few of them on in a couple of Fridays. Do either of you have any comments on that, Angelo?
I think that one thing that I would say is I would draw, you know, when we're talking about a policy fight or and there's somebody that's there in good faith, you know, a lot of I think it's fine to have a little bit of perspective and balance. That said, I think a lot, and I think, and this is where I'm in total alignment with the caller. A lot of that's usually not the context that these people are brought on in. You know, a lot of times we end up bringing on, and this is more of a general critique, but that, you know, they're talking about culture issues, they're talking about things where there really aren't both sides, and this is it underscores one of the problems that we've had with the right wing is that not only do they attack the media, but they do it in a way to work the refs so that their lies can be privileged. And so to me, my dividing line for bringing on versus not bringing on is, am I doing this simply to maintain the perception of false balance on something that doesn't need to exist, climate change, basic civil rights, that kind of stuff? Then there really is nothing to balance, and they really shouldn't have a seat at the table, especially because they have their own echo chamber to push those kinds of disinformation and attacks and that perspective. So, no, but I think it's good to debate, and I think that's what makes talk radio amazing. I just think that – mine is more a question of what's the subcategory. And on certain things, they really have benefited from that desire to create an atmosphere of clash that they've been able to exploit and use. And I do think we need, you know, broadly a major correction on this.
Right. Emily, what would you add?
Yeah, I agree. And I just want to say, you know, I think it's important, as Angelo said, to draw a distinction between, you know, extreme right-wing misinformation operatives and just conservative mainstream Republicans. These are not the same. That's not the same category of person at all. And my research right now, I'm researching, you know, the last 10 years of partisanship in the U.S. And, you know, in fact, many of the people who are on the fringe far right and who are the ones who have the most extreme, you know, white supremacist views or sexist views, they are antagonistic to the Republicans and the Republican Party in the same way that they are to the Democratic Party. And so I would just say that I think our nation is becoming more partisan and feeling more partisan. And I do think it is important that we have representation on platforms like NPR for the middle ground, that is like an actual real consensus space that exists and when there are fewer differences than we might think, that we should probably highlight that. But that is totally different than bringing on like a fringe white supremacist to talk about Charlottesville or whatever. That should not happen, because when they are given that kind of platform, not only does it amplify their own beliefs, but it functions to make those fringe beliefs seem like they are more part of the middle than they are, when in fact they actually are quite fringe.
Well, thank you for that call. We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about a few other outlets here. A lot of people say they get a lot of their news from their local TV station, and this is really important. I'm glad we talked about right-wing radio, but now let's talk a little bit about the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, because they own 193 local stations across the United States. And Angelo, your colleague Zachary Pleat writes that since Sinclair's The National Desk launched in mid-January, its anchors, reporters, and guests have regularly misinformed their viewers about topics like COVID, immigration, the economy, education, U.S. democracy. They're allowing Republicans to come on to push debunked treatments like Ivermectin. They said that the infrastructure bill would add $400 trillion to the national debt. And what's, I think, so dangerous about these stations is that they're in many, many parts of the country, and they tend to repeat the same script. So for people who aren't familiar with Sinclair, can you just tell us a little bit about the reach they have and why they're so important to talk about?
So Sinclair is, like you said, it's a network of the company that owns a lot of local news stations. But what's important to keep in mind there is that even though they own a lot of local news stations, they don't run them all as like independent, individual, separated local news channels. Instead, they create some content that is universal that they run across the entire network. And that is both individual shows and packages, news packages, and then reads that they make all of their news anchors, regardless of their location, pick up. And then the other piece, and this ties into something you said earlier, is that they sometimes pick up on narratives that they then produce individually across the major networks. So back in 2018, they were running a series of attacks at across the country on homelessness and poverty. And what they were basically in all of the cities that they had Sinclair stations that were run by Democrats, they ran local news segments, segment after segment after segment. They had a series called Poverty Nation, where all they did was attack Democratic policies as being the root cause of homelessness. And it was an attempt to roll back all sorts of social services at the local level, claiming that it would restore, you know, actually reduce homelessness and make everything better. That was something that they set at the national level, but it felt like an individual story. And it really matters for this one reason, that people still trust their local news, regardless of their – it's one of the few things that there is a lot of both attention toward at the local level and trust. And they prey on that trust because you don't – when you're watching something, you don't really know it's a Sinclair station. That's not part of their branding. It just happens to be the company that owns the affiliate.
Well, let's just hear a quick clip before we have to end. This is Sinclair hosts, TV hosts, repeating the exact same copy, and this is from 2018.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But
we are concerned about trouble in trying to be responsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and
false news has become all too common on social media.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
So that gives you a sense of Sinclair hosts basically repeating the same information. Emily, we want to do an entire show about media literacy. We also want to do a show about people who've lost loved ones to especially right-wing media. We got an email from a listener yesterday who said that she lost her husband to Fox. What are your thoughts about media literacy and just the importance of talking about this?
I mean, you know, I'm a little bit cynical because media literacy is so important, obviously, and I think it can help. And when people know how this works and they understand what Sinclair is and what they're looking at and how it functions, I think that can be helpful. But I also think that this is an ecosystem-wide problem, and in some ways, it's a little difficult to ask individuals to be the ones to take on the burden of protecting themselves against it. That I mean, that is the situation we're in right now. So individuals do need to do that. But ideally, we really need, you know, systemic changes, because some of the things that enable Sinclair to have that power is that there are fewer local news outlets, print outlets left, or there are all these local news deserts where then the local TV station has much more importance and impact, and the consolidation of the industries allows this kind of stuff to happen. And so, yes, I think literacy is important and will help, but I really hope that there are bigger changes that we can make as an industry or a country to help people.
Angela, what would you add? We have just about 30 seconds.
I would say that we live in an environment where, you know, no matter what the issue is, the media is going to affect the outcome. And, you know, I think media literacy is really important, but I totally agree with Emily. I think that it's much deeper and more systemic than that at this point. Hmm.
Well, thank you both so much for the great work that you do, and we'd love to have you back. Angelo Corusone is president and CEO of Media Matters. You can find a lot of their reports at yourcallradio.org. Emily Dreyfus is senior editor at the Technology and Social Change Project at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Emily and Angelo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.